Hello, this is Robert Noya, Editor-in-Chief of Sky and Telescope Magazine. I'm on the phone with Caltech astronomer Robert Quimby, who is a leading researcher studying unusually energetic supernovae. These so-called overluminous supernovae are the subjects of our October issue cover story by David Stevenson, a science writer in the UK. Robert, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our pleasure. Well, first of all, for decades, astronomers seem to be finding supernovae that most of them fit comfortably into a few relatively well-defined categories. But now astronomers are finding oddballs, some of which are considerably more luminous than typical supernovae, and some of which are actually less luminous as well. Why have all these weird supernovae started to turn up in the past few years?
We've actually been able to look in much greater detail into supernova in recent years. In the past, we've mainly focused on looking in particular galaxies. But now we're able to look at just large patches of the sky. So we can find the supernova that occur in those big galaxies that were preferentially targeted before. And we can also find things in little dwarf galaxies where people hadn't previously found supernova. And so part of the answer may be that in different environments, there are just different types of supernova. And the other part of the puzzle is that we're now getting much more detailed information on individual events. So when we find a detection of a supernova, we don't just say, oh, it's a supernova, and move on. We actually get a spectrum of it, and we can study in great detail.
And now, the article talks about a number of specific overluminous supernovae, but in general, like what fraction or percentage of supernovae would you consider to be kind of oddballs that don't fit in with the standard picture?
What's odd to me is not odd to someone else, so it's a bit subjective, but I think everyone would agree that with modern searches, the actual supernova that are detected, something like a few percent maybe are actually very peculiar. Now, this is actually in the discovery. We're discovering these. That doesn't mean that that's the rate that these are occurring in the universe. It could be that the rate is actually higher, but we preferentially find what we think of as normal things, which are a little bit brighter than these other events.
So the article talks also not only about supernovae, but the supernova imposter events, which are actually not exploding stars, but which look like exploding stars. So some of our readers might find it strange that a star ejecting its outer envelope, like Eta Carinae in the 1840s, could be mistaken for an actual exploding star. How do you and your fellow astronomers distinguish a supernova imposter from a genuine supernova?
Well, the truth is, in some cases, it can be really difficult. In the optimal case, we might find, say, a typical type 1A supernova. And we know that that is an exploding star because we can look at the spectra of it, and we can look at the velocities of the different lines. So in a type 1A supernova, there's a characteristic line from silicon, and that line is actually blue-shifted, because the star is exploding. So if you think of, you know, you're looking at a star that's far away, and the ejecta, it's exploding, so the material from the star is coming right at you, and it's coming at you at very high velocity. And so because of that, the light is actually blue-shifted a little bit. This is on top of the redshift, you know, the star could be very far away. So if we see a star exploding that has very high velocities, then we know that it is a proper explosion. But now there are some other supernovae that have lower velocities, and these are the ones that can be very difficult to disentangle from supernova imposters. The velocity signature is not as strong as otherwise would be. So in some cases, it actually is quite tricky.
And the article also describes various models that seem to give reasonably good explanations for some of the unusual supernova that have been seen over the past few years. For example, there's the pulsation, the pair instability supernova, there's the magnetar model that's briefly discussed. Were these models developed before or after astronomers started seeing these oddballs? In other words, were they developed in response to seeing these peculiar supernovae, or were they types of events that astronomers expected to see, and now finally with these surveys that you discussed earlier, we're starting to see these more unusual events?
I would say in all cases, the seeds for the theory were planted long before the discoveries. But I have to say that there is a lot of development that is being spurred by these new discoveries. So, for example, some of the first models for parent stability supernova were discussed in the 1960s, but these are now being updated and changed to explain events that we're finding in the local universe. So it wasn't expected that these types of supernova would be found in the local universe. They thought that these were just the first types of supernova to explode. So now there's been some developments in the theory to explain how we can see these things in the local universe.
And how much confidence do astronomers such as yourself have in these models? I mean, it sounds like in certain cases they do a pretty good job of explaining these different observations of these unusual supernovae. But could it be that some of these supernovae are the result of explosion mechanisms that have not yet been conceived by theorists?
I suppose that's possible. I tend to believe that the theorists we have are pretty bright, and they've been working on these problems for decades. So I think most of the component physics is already available. It's just a matter of putting that together in a consistent package that can explain what we're seeing. So I think that the models that are developed are very promising, although, you know, there always could be something that we've overlooked.
And it would seem that a big determining factor then of how a star is going to explode, it would seem the two biggest factors are, one, its initial mass, and number two, its composition, whether it was born in the early universe and is made of pure hydrogen and helium, or whether it came later and maybe is enriched in heavier elements like carbon, silicon, oxygen, nitrogen, etc. You might also have a binary companion would affect a star's evolution. Do you think those are the main factors that dictate how a star is going to die?
Yeah, they should be. On some level, you know, a star is just what it formed from. So if you have different endpoints, then you should have different beginning points. So it's been long believed that differences in the composition of the star are some of the main causes of differences in types of supernova we observe after, of course, you take into the mass into consideration. So mass is really the leading driver for the different endpoints of stellar evolution.
I would think, too, that these unusual supernovae that have been observed in recent years are probably the result of very, very massive stars going supernovae. When I think of a typical core collapse supernova, I'm generally thinking of a star of maybe 8 to 30 solar masses. But it seems like these unusual supernovae are being produced by stars of like 50 or 100 or maybe even 200 solar masses. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, just looking at the light we see from some of these recent supernova, and just looking at how the light curves behave, how slow they are evolving, just everything about them just evokes this picture of a very massive star. So we do believe that we're actually starting to see stars in the 100 solar mass, maybe even up to 200 solar mass range, exploding.
Yeah, and since those stars are not very common in the nearby universe, then the supernovae that result from them would also be, you know, relatively uncommon as well.
That's right.
And the article, too, one of the things I found really interesting, it talks about these brilliant blue supernovae that you and your colleagues have been studying, such as SCP-06F6. What could be causing those types of explosions?
These are very interesting events because they're very bright, very luminous, but they don't have hydrogen in their spectra. And that's an interesting clue because, well, all stars are formed with a significant amount of hydrogen. So something had to happen to these stars before they exploded to get rid of that hydrogen so that we don't see it. And then the other interesting point is that you would expect that if a star was very massive, of course it started off with a very massive hydrogen envelope, and one of the easiest ways to make a star supernova brighter is to crash the ejecta of a supernova into this extended hydrogen envelope. You basically can convert the kinetic energy of the supernova ejecta into luminosity through this process. But what we're seeing is we have these supernova that don't have hydrogen and are still very luminous. So basically the standard models for a core collapse supernova can't produce something that is so bright. So the other possibility is that maybe there's a radioactive process which is powering them. So you could imagine that if there was a tremendous amount of nickel produced, this is a radioactive element, it decays into cobalt, decays into iron, and through that process it releases energy. If you take that energy from that decay and let it heat up the ejecta, perhaps that's what's powering the glow. But it turns out that these events just fade too fast for that to happen. So we have to look towards a new explanation. There's a couple possibilities for what may be going on here. One of them is that there was a pulsation that occurred before the star exploded, and this cast off a shell of material that was moving very fast, and it has to still be hydrogen-poor material. And then if the supernova interacts with that, that could possibly explain the bright peak luminosity. The other possibility is that you could have a fairly normal supernova, but inside of it you form a rapidly spinning, highly magnetized source called a magnetar. And as this magnetar, the rotation of this magnetar slows down, the release of that energy could help power the light curve of the supernova.
The article also discusses the extremely luminous supernova 2007 BI and the possibility that it could be the first known example of a long theorized event known as a pair instability supernova. Do you think the evidence is pretty strong in favor that this 2007 BI supernova was in fact one of these extremely energetic supernovae?
Yeah, I do actually. There's two compelling pieces of information. One is the decay of the light curve, so how it fades over time. And what we see is that it stays bright for a very long time, and this is consistent with there being a lot of heating from radioactive material. And you need a lot of radioactive material to explain this, and more than you can explain with other flavors of supernova, but a value that's consistent with this pair instability model. But perhaps the more compelling evidence is from the spectra. So we actually have spectroscopy taken at late times so we can see what the composition of the inner workings of the supernova are. And what we find is that there was a lot of iron peak elements. So we can actually measure this. And we see that there's more iron peak elements produced in this supernova than there are typically in other events, spectroscopically. So we believe that this is actually consistent with this pair instability model.
And it's interesting that the stars that are supposed to produce these pair instability supernovae, you know, are supposed to only really exist in the very early universe when stars were forming from clouds of pure hydrogen and helium. So how would you get a star? I mean, because these progenitors are thought to be, you know, over 130, 140 solar masses, and such stars really aren't forming commonly today, you know, how could you get these very luminous supernovae occurring, you know, within current range of our telescopes?
So metals hurt you in two ways. One is that to make a massive star, first you have to form a massive ball. And there has been theories that predict that if you include metals into protostellar gas, that when the star is actually forming, it'll fracture. And so instead of getting one big star, you get a bunch of small stars. Now there's been some recent work that suggests that maybe metallicity is not so important in fracturing, so that you can actually form these massive cores. So perhaps it is possible to form these massive stars in the local universe where there's a higher metallicity. Now, the other thing is that this star has to retain its mass to its endpoint. And this is, again, where metallicity can hurt you, because if you have metals in your atmosphere, these can drive winds which blow off material from the star. So you expect heavy mass loss, and so basically as the star is living its short life, it is constantly losing material. But again, there has been some recent work which suggests that this line-driven mass loss process may not be quite as important as we previously thought. So these two things together may be suggesting that, and the fact that we seem to be discovering these supernovae in the local universe could be suggesting that there are some more important processes, and perhaps metallicity is not as important as we once thought it was.
And the article doesn't really go into this topic, but besides these overluminous supernovae that have been seen recently, these surveys are also turning up underluminous supernovae, supernovae that are, you know, you could say are wimpier than the typical, you know, type 1A or type 2 supernova. What could be causing some of these events?
Yeah, so we're very interested in these with Palomar transient factor, and we've actually started finding a few different varieties of these. So some of them could actually be related to core collapse supernova, but a slightly different process. So you start with a slightly lower mass star than you would get in a typical core collapse supernova, and you go through what's called an electron capture process. So the core and contracts and releases energy, and that blows off the star, but it's a much weaker explosion than you get in a normal supernova. So that could be explaining some of these events. Another group of events that we're finding are maybe what they're referring to as point 1A explosions. So these are something that looks something like a type 1A supernova, except for it's about a tenth as bright and lasts about a tenth as long.
Could they be like a white dwarf merger that doesn't get to the Chandrasekhar limit?
Yeah, that's one possibility that could be involved. There's another class of events where you actually have a star which is in the process of shedding its envelope. So you have this core, and it's got this extended envelope above it, and it is still accreting some material. So it grows up, the core mass grows a little bit, and then there's this instability. It runs away, there's burning in this outer envelope of the core, and then the process repeats over and over. And it can be the case that you can get one of these cycles, the final cycle, where there's enough energy to actually cause a thermonuclear runaway. And you get something that looks very much like a type 1A supernova, except for you're just burning this thin layer of material, so you only got about a tenth of the material available as you would in a type 1A supernova. So it could be that we're starting to see, and we do see with Palomar Transient Factor, we see events that look consistent with what the model predicts.
That answers the questions I had, Robert, but was there anything else that you'd like to add that I didn't ask you about?
So the work I did for my my dissertation actually spurred much of what's being read about in this article. We discovered 2006 July, we discovered 2005 AP, which is one of these first bright blue transients that don't have hydrogen in them. So it all started there with this very simple, modest telescope. And I'd like to give some credit to Texas, especially my advisor, Craig Wheeler.
Well, thank you very much, Robert. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.